From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
Well, if you think that this is the end of days, if you think that we're in the end times, that avarice, infantilism, xenophobia, and bigotry are taking us all to the end of the world, I've got some good news for you.
I hope so.
At least next month, we'll get an increase in public funding and maybe we'll draw a good night. And of course, if you don't understand those references, it's because I'm talking about Pandemic Legacy, the number one board game of all time, because we are here with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM for episode 143 on the 24th of November 2016, talking about board games, card games, tabletop games, the fun you have with your nerdy mates around the kitchen table or the man cave table. And I'm joined tonight by Garth.
Hello, long time no speak.
Garth, are you well?
I am very well, thank
you. It's not often that you and I get this time alone in the studio, Garth, because no Leon tonight, no Trent, although Trent is here.
I know, we're almost living the dream,
yeah,
but not quite.
Trent is here with, he's going to intro his interview with Vital Lacerda, the man of the moment.
I did hear that you teased this interview last week.
We did.
I'm very looking forward to hearing it because apparently Vital is the sexiest man in board gaming. Is that right?
Well, so Trent says, which maybe says more about Trent than it does about Vital. But look, you know, what a combination. You've got Vital Lacerda, the sexiest man in board games. You've got Ian O'Toole, the nicest, most talented man in board games.
Yes.
What a team. And we're going to be talking all Lisboa all the time.
That's pretty much what this show is, isn't it? It's a Lisboa slash Vital slash Ian love fest. So we are going to start with a... How long ago were we at PAX now? Like four weeks? But it was arguably one of the experiences of PAX. It was our last full game of that last Sunday of PAX where we got to sit down, myself, you and Leon, with Ian O'Toole, the graphic designer and artist on Lisboa, sit down and spend three and a half hours trying to figure out this masterpiece. We're going to talk about that as what we've been playing, followed it up by an interview that Trent was able to do with Vital only a couple of days ago. And then, just to change tack completely, you're just going to tell us how to spend our money, is that right?
That's right. I'm going to talk about Kickstarter and...
Is there something on Kickstarter you want to talk about?
There's this crazy game on Kickstarter by the Dream Team, Vital and Ian. We might talk about that and some other Kickstarters. We've got all that and more coming up on the Dice Men. Yes, that was Work by the Wet Blankets. You're with Edge Radio 99.3 FM. We are the Dice Men Cometh. Here talking about board games, card games, tabletop games, role-playing games, miniatures games.
No, we're not.
We're not talking about any of that stuff tonight, are we, Garth?
No, we're talking about one game.
One
Pretty
game.
Much.
But it is the game of the moment.
Yes.
And we are some of the few people, perhaps, in the world that have actually played this game. Probably some of the very few people to play this game with the graphic designer and artist, of course. But
Correct.
Garth, what have we been playing lately?
Oh, my goodness. We have been playing Lisboa.
Oh, yes.
Now, we're not going to tease what Lisboa is. We're going to tell you what it is because this is the new game by Vital Lacerda, who, look, let's talk about his games previously.
Oh, yes.
CO2.
Yes.
Okay, now, we tried to play this one at BorderCon a couple of years
ago. That's right.
Wrong time, wrong place. But let's just say, thinky game. Trying to deal with carbon dioxide side, saving the planet, all of that kind of thing.
And I can't wait to try it, that's for
and
sure.
And no doubt we will mention that again. Vinos, which is the wine heavy Euro game, which has recently come out by Eagle Griffin Games with their 2016 version, where it's come out with double-sided board technology.
Oh, yeah.
Where you have the full game and then you have the simplified game so that you can play a speedy game should you want to. You have Kanban.
Oh,
the
yes.
Automotive revolution where you, yes, you get to live the dream that we've all had of being a worker inside a Japanese car factory.
Well, it's not just that. You do all the jobs.
All the things. Run the factory.
You design the cars. You buy the parts. You train the workers. You push the cars along the assembly line.
You avoid that evil boss that you've got.
Yes, yes. Evil Sandra.
There we go. And then the Gallerist, which I think it's pretty clear, especially amongst the Dice Men, that this is one of the most beautiful games that we have ever had the joy of playing. Not just from a graphic design and illustration point of view, thanks Ian, but also from a game mechanic point of view as well.
And thematic integration, and look, if there's one thing, I'm not going to talk about one thing with Vital because he's a man of many things, but one of the things he does so well is thematic integration and how that ties into how the game works. Like, it just makes sense. The theme and the mechanics tie together so beautifully in all of his games. And I'm sure, as you're going to tell us, Garth, it's no different with Lisboa.
No, it's not. So let's start with giving everyone a bit of an idea of what the hell Lisboa is. Because when we were sitting down and playing this game...
yes.
How many people walked past and asked us, what is this game?
Almost every person that walked past our table sort of did a double take, triple take, like, what is that?
Yeah, and look, there is a reason for that, and it is that it is a table hog. This game, you need at least a 6-person table, at least, to be able to put the full board, all of the player aids, all of the meeples, all of the money, all of the goods, all of the everything. And even then, you are struggling for space to find, you know, room for a wine glass or a beer glass or a glass of water or, I don't know, a sticky bun. Who knows? But the point is, this is a table hog and commands attention.
Yep.
Now, what the game is actually about, and I will just start by reading the introduction that Vital gives this game in the rulebook because he knows it better because he is from Portugal.
Yes.
So this game is very, very personal because... he is from Portugal. This game is set in Lisbon, or Lisboa, as they say in Portuguese. And it relates way back to this cataclysmic event in 1755 on All Saints' Day, where Lisboa, for the purposes of the game, suffered an earthquake that they say reached somewhere between 8.5 and 9 on the Richter scale.
Wow.
Which is bloody intense.
Yes.
Followed by a tsunami... which is also kind of, you know, inconvenient.
Yes.
And then 3 days of fires.
Thank God the kaijus didn't follow.
I reckon. So that would have been a nasty bit of time in Lisbon's history. Now, at that time, there was the Marquis of Pombal. Now, he was the Prime Minister. There
was
also
his name, Garth?
It was Sebastião José de Cavalheiro. E. Mello.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for that. Now, the king had put him in charge of reconstruction. Now, could you imagine being the guy that is put in charge of the reconstruction of a whole city when it's just suffered earthquake, followed by tsunami, followed by 3 days of fire, just to make sure everything was really, really damaged?
Absolutely. There was a whole lot of stuff going on, that's for sure.
Now, what is really impressive is this thing all happened on the 1st of November, 1755. By the 4th of December, 1755, which is just over a month after that all happened, they've got the chief engineer, Manuel de Maia, and he's just gone, here's my plans. I've got a couple of different plans for what I want to do with Lisboa. I either want to just give it all up, move it somewhere down the road. I want to rebuild it using all of the damaged buildings, damaged infrastructure that's already there. I want to recreate Lisbon and basically make it this amazing capital city of Iberia.
Yeah.
What do you want to do, royalty? And then the royalty side decided, yeah, you know what we're going to do? We're going to build this bloody perfect version of Lisboa, and we're going to do it really, really quickly, but it's going to require a lot of work, a lot of political influence, a lot of nobles to make sure that the funds are there.
A lot of meeples.
A lot of meeples, a fair bit of trading,
and
let's just say it's going to look very, very nice at the end of it. Because this is going to be the game where you recreate the rebuilding of Lisbon from 1755 onward. It sort of played out over, from memory, about a 22-year span.
Yes.
And it starts with, and this is where I really love. Now, one of the things that I really do like about Vital's games is his thematic integration, which you know, you touched on briefly.
Yeah.
One of the hard things about a lot of his games, because they are so complicated, is the setup. The setup of these games can quite typically take you half an hour, 45 minutes or so, because you've got to make sure you put X number of meeples here, you've got to make sure you got that deck shuffled, you've got to make
lots
this,
of little stacks of chits and cardboard bits and meeples and dollars. And
yeah, and all of those bits and pieces, which are obviously, that's how the game starts.
Mm.
But it's a bit of a lull, I guess, in the game night, because this is going to be one of those games where you might have played something lighter, or you've done something to wait for everyone to arrive, and this is the centerpiece of the night, like almost all of his other games. But what I really appreciate about the setup is you almost start in a way that a lot of the local Lisboans started, in that you're setting up by placing rubble through the city.
Yes.
You've got a rubble bag which has three different types of rubble. You've got the rubble that is caused by the earthquake. You've then got, and that's all brown cubes. You've then got red cubes, which signify 3 days of fire. And you've got blue cubes that signify the tsunami.
The water damage.
Yeah, so you've got the three different types of damage. And you're going to start by placing these randomly around the city, because what do you reckon, about a quarter to a third of the board is made up of this sort of overlay of what the city of Lisbon
sort of like
is going
to
form.
The blank for the streets.
Yeah.
Where let's lay out the streets nice and even in a beautiful grid, and we'll structure it so that all businesses of a similar nature are in the same district.
Yeah. And that was a really concerted effort and a deliberate decision by the nobility and by the architects to make sure that Lisbon became, and the CBD area particularly, became a really structured environment where if I'm going to be a merchant who wants to sell tools and those kind of things, I'm going to have to go on Tool Street.
Yeah.
If I want to be a merchant that deals in gold and finery, well, I'm going on Gold Street.
Yeah.
And similarly, if I'm lucky enough to be able to deal in silks, I'm getting
Silky
on Silks,
Avenue,
Silk
yeah.
Street. Yeah, of course. And that's where this board is beautiful, in that it lays it out really, really clearly. This is what Lisbon looks like. But then the game starts.
Mm.
And this is, having played now quite a few of Vital's games, this is immediately where you start putting your thinking cap on and going,
Yeah.
Because unlike a lot of his other games, where you start the game going, I know what I need to do.
Yes.
I know I need to do this, to do this, to do this, to do this. Or at least, That's probably the smartest first move. The first move I should do is blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, well, the gallerist, obviously, okay, I need to fill up my gallery with art.
Yep.
And I'm also going to have to sell some art to give me money to do the filling up of the gallery. So I better get art. That's a good start.
Exactly right, yeah. Whereas this one, it basically gives you this open slather of, this is where you're starting. Now, what do you want to do, Mark? How do you want to rebuild Lisboa? How do you want to make sure that ultimately you get not the most victory points, but the most wigs?
Wigs.
Because,
it's all about the wigs.
And again, in the rulebook, it quite clearly gives you an idea, why are wigs used instead of victory points? The reason is wigs were the height of men's fashion at that time, which basically means that if you were an average Joe like you and me, you might be able to afford one wig, and you've got to be really careful about the wig that you buy, because that's the one.
Yes.
That's the one that you're going to use to impress some girls or some boys or your neighbours,
or
you
king.
Might get invited to a dinner. However, if you are the king, you might have 50 wigs and you might wear your Monday the 23rd of November wig. Who knows? But wigs are an important historical part of this, which is why they are the replacement for victory points.
Yeah.
So,
it's all about the wigs.
How do you want to actually, as that, let's say, architect or that person who is involved in the rebuilding of Lisbon, how do you want to make sure that you are the most successful?
Mm.
Well, that, Mark, is a very tricky equation.
It is.
Now, we could talk how to play this game and we would be done maybe by the show next week.
Yeah.
But needless to say, like so many of Vital's games, the basics are so simple, but what the basics lead into is just a wonderful piece of strategic worker placement, heavy, well, let's say medium to heavy Euro style of game. Because the way every turn is basically going to work is you're going to play one of the five cards in your hand.
Yeah.
That's all you're going to do. But of course, what you do with that card is really, really important. Yes. Because that card itself has three placements that you can put it. Now, one, and I'll start with one, is that every player is going to have their own individual player board, which is called the portfolio. Now, the portfolio is your own little action space where you'll be able to keep resources that you've built. You'll be able to keep architects, because there are two different styles of architects, mm-hmm. blue and green in there. You'll be able to keep favors from the three nobles that you may visit during the course of the yep. game. You'll be able to keep your money there. You're also going to keep the buildings that you haven't quite built yet. You yep. also keep some workers there that you're going to be sending out in the hopes of using them to be able to gain more influence or to be able to actually use those workers to build structures.
Don't forget your trade ships.
No, well, I haven't. Because part of what you'll do with your portfolio is you're going to add to that by adding in trade ships or individuals which will give you, let's just say, game boosts that will apply as long as you've got them in your portfolio. Yeah. Because the other thing you're going to have on this game board, your portfolio, is this tiny little section. It might only be, let's just say, the size of two boxes of matches, which is your rubble collection yes. area. And I certainly failed to appreciate how important that is, because what that is signifying how much you can fit in your portfolio. Because at the start of the game, everyone's only going to be able to fit a couple of cards in yeah. there. You might be able to fit one trading ship, which will be the basic trading ship that allows you to sell some goods. Not just you. Anyone can put goods on your ship because, again, with a lot of Vital's games, they're so interactive. Yes, it might be your turn, Mark, but I don't need to switch off as a player who's two people away to your left, because whatever you do is very much so going to interact with what I have to do as my strategy, and doubly more so if I have one of the favours from the royalty, because after you get from the portfolio, another one of the actions you can do with that one card that you're spending is send it to the main game board and talk to one of the three nobles that are there.
Yeah, and this is the bit when we started playing, I didn't appreciate it as much because we were all playing cards to our player board to get influence, firstly, because you need to move along the influence track, because like some of the other Vital games, you can use influence as money.
Yes.
In cases that you run out of money. And so I didn't appreciate that following. But it also happens in the Gallerist where when you bump someone off a space, that person also gets to do like a sort of a lesser version of that action. And it's almost, in some cases, it's a bit like the Puerto Rico or the Glory to Rome thing where people get to follow you and do a similar action or maybe a slightly less powered version of that action.
That's right, because when you visit these nobles, they're going to give you specific actions that they can do. And the way it works is the five cards that you've got, each of those cards will either be a resource card, basically. A treasury card is what they call them in the game, where it's got a bunch of items or benefits on them. Or you're going to have one of the three noble pictures on it. And they are green and blue and pink from memory.
Yeah.
And that will designate, I'm going to go and visit the pink nobility, which happens to be the king, or I'm going to go and visit the green one, who is Manuel de Meyer, and he's the builder, or I'm going to go to the marquis, who is the minister, and he, you know, does some other abilities. Mm. So as the player, I can choose, no, I don't want to put my card in the top half of my portfolio. I'll go and visit the noble, and that will allow me to do certain actions depending on which noble I've decided to visit. But yeah, as you say, that opens up the ability for anyone else on the board to follow my action if they have one of the favours from that very same noble.
Yes.
And that's where you've really got to be sort of concentrating on not just what is my plan, but what are the players around me doing? Because very much like Puerto Rico, you want to make sure that on your turn, A, you're either getting resources or you're getting a benefit or you're earning some victory points, but you're also limiting the opportunities for your opponents to basically get a free kind of action.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what I love about especially the Gallerist in this one, which is the two Vital games I've had the most experience with. So that's the second action. And again, I'm not going into very much detail because we'd be here forever.
Yeah.
The third action with the cards is you can play it on the lower half of your portfolio, which gives you other benefits that are generally more permanent changes to what you will receive when you do further actions. So at the top of the top half of the portfolio, you'll probably be putting a ship down there
yes.
to be able to then ship your goods, or you'll be playing a character which increases your influence or your wigs when you get to scoring. Whereas at the bottom half, it's more about a permanent benefit, which might be every time you get a good, you get one more,
yeah, yeah.
or every time you get some gold, you get some more, or something along those lines. And there are numerous other versions.
And as you said, that Rubblearium, your Rubble Manifesto,
yep.
is the thing that as you fill up a line of the three different types of rubble...
Yeah, you've got to get a set of earthquake and fire and tsunami damage.
That lets you have one more card on your player board.
Yeah.
And when you start, you don't realise, oh, well, now I've got a ship... and I've got one card, that's my two cards. I can't play another card there, so I've got to go to the board. And then the board is where other people can follow you. So the rubble just becomes super important.
Exactly. Now let's get to that bit.
Mm.
Because a major part of this game is that you need to build shops.
Yes.
Because the way this works is you have to build shops to be able to get goods. You have to then get goods to be able to ship them. By shipping them gives you money. And money is how you're going to sort of contribute to winning the game. So there's a very simple way in that you can theoretically explain this game is that you need workers to be able to build stuff. You need to build stuff to get the goods. You need ships to be able to ship the goods out to be able to sort of go along the way and raise your standing and get wigs.
And then you need to build the public buildings around the edge of
Correct.
The city, which then sort of combine in a gritty type way, grid-like perhaps, to give... bonus points to those buildings that you and other people have built.
Or points at all.
Yeah.
And this is something that I really, really like because, look, I'm not going to try and explain it. Jump onto the current Kickstarter or Board Game Geek and just have a look at the board because it will very clearly show you how the layout of Lisboa is in this game because you've got the row of buildings, which is, you know, there's a double-sided street where you've got gold. You've then got the pink, which is the silks next to it. You've then got the brown one next to that, and you've got the blue one, which is the tools next to that. But when you place a building, you will have a choice of which way it's facing,
yeah.
i.e. which street is it on. So I can choose, oh, I want that building to be on the gold street, or I flip it the other way around and it's on silk street.
Yeah.
But that is permanent. You can't halfway through the game decide, oh, my silk shop's not doing so well, I'm going to start selling gold instead. And that this is where the public buildings become really, really important because they are how you are going to score your buildings. Because at the very top of every avenue, for example, you've got four spaces where the public buildings will go, and they go down the left and right-hand side as well. But the public buildings, when you place them, will clearly show what category of building that they're going to score.
Yeah.
So you could place them on top of a building that score... on top of an avenue that's going to score the silks and... let's say silks and tools, which don't work necessarily well together, or silks and gold, or some combination thereof.
Yeah.
And where you place it really makes a big difference to the end-of-game scoring.
Mm.
And I love that simple idea that you can't just be solely focused on, I'm going to be the best silk merchant. You need to keep aware of what is going to be in the best interest of Lisbon itself and create the right public buildings.
Well, and it's also about, okay, who else has buildings on this avenue or on this section of the grid? Because if I don't build a public building here, well, Garth, you might, but you're not going to choose the gold buildings to score. You're going to choose the tools or the books or something else.
Yeah.
And because the grid isn't going to line up, I'm going to have built buildings. They might give me goods, but they're not going to give me any points at all
yeah.
if the public buildings don't align to give me points. And that is a huge portion of your points in this game.
Is it ever? And I just love that. And what I really enjoy is the fact that you get to see everything. You get to see these are the public buildings that are able to be bought and built. There's no real secret information. The only thing that is kept hidden is those five cards in your hand.
Yeah.
And even those... should someone be of the disposition of the mental aptitude, they will know what you've got because you're drawing from four, a face-up pile.
Yeah.
So everyone There's no real secret information here.
Yeah, no randomness really, apart from those cards coming up.
Yeah,
but because you've always got a choice of one of the four piles. You're right. The randomness is completely gone. The only other thing that you could say is random is those decree cards that come out that give you extra end of game scoring, but they'll come out at random, but they're all there's always six or eight of them, that's right, face up for you to choose from. So they're there for everyone to see.
And look, let's just briefly talk about the decree cards. The decree cards are end of game scoring. They are something that is very different. And look, we both talked before the show about having watched the Man vs. Meeple review and the Rado runs through and seeing some other comments. And look, a lot of the comments have been along the lines of this is a very sandboxy kind of game in that you get to choose your strategy. What that strategy is, well, you kind of potentially figure out away you go. And this is where the decree cards come into it, because all they are is end of game scoring.
Yes.
And they might say, well, if you've got the most buildings on this row of Lisboa, you're going to get X number of points. Or if you have this many workers, you're going to get this number of points. So a lot of people have been discussing on why doesn't every player start with a decree card to give you a bit of direction?
Yeah, yeah.
And other people have been saying, well, there's always eight of them out there. Why don't you just use an action to get some and give yourself some direction? And look, having only played this game once with Ian, which was fantastic, I don't have a legitimate opinion to be able to say this is the better way to go. All I can say is that I was always keeping an eye on what decree cards were out there, so that every action that I took, particularly the ones that involved placing buildings, I wasn't always looking at what is my immediate benefit going to be when I place a building. I had one eye on this is the end of game stuff, and if I can grab this decree card, it's going to give me 5 or 10 extra points.
And that, to me, that was my biggest shortcoming in how I played the game, was I got very few degree cards, and I spotted two or three that would combo really nicely, but because I was focused on building, then I never got them. And I did okay. I mean, I came second to Ian, who's obviously played this game a few times.
Yes.
But I didn't get the decree cards that could have really made a difference. And certainly I would be keeping an eye on that a lot more and prioritising that a lot more the next time I play, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Now, there are a couple of...
You get a lot of them, you're getting between sort of 1 and 5 or 6 points per card, which... Like 5 or 6 points is potentially a lot of points in this game.
It is. So, look, there's a hell of a lot more to this, but I'm just I'm a bit concerned that we're going to run out of time talking
about
this.
Yeah, look, we have been talking
about
it.
So let's have
a
break. And what we're going to do is just let Trent and Vital Lacerda talk about their games for a little bit.
Yeah,
how about
absolutely.
We do that and let Vital talk for us? So let's go to a song. We'll come back right after this. Well, there you go. That ended really nicely, didn't it? That was Scott Dracula with Disintegrator. You're with the Edgemen.
The Edgemen Cometh on Dice
man.
Radio.
So it shows you I've been haven't been here for a while. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3. Now, Trent had the privilege, the pleasure, and the obligation to speak to Vital Lacerda only a couple of days ago. So we're just going to throw you straight into the conversation where Trent starts asking about Lisboa.
This is the story of the rebuilding of Lisbon after the earthquake of 1755 and players and noblemen rebuilding the city that that you live in. And players are also competing for wigs. What's going on there?
Wigs at that time was very important, because only the nobles, the wealthiest men, can afford more than one wig. The bigger the wigs, more important was the person. So, and since the team is a little bit far down, right, because it was a disaster and many people died, I want to give a little bit of fun. I want to place a little bit of fun into the team. It was a sad day because it was 1 November, All Saints Day. People were at the church with a lot of light candles. That's why they suffer 3 days of fires. Mm. And the people who survive in Lisbon ran to next to the river, and a big tsunami came and killed most of the people there. So it was a big disaster in Europe, one of the biggest at the 18th century. But fortunately, at that time, you had good leaders. And one guy, the Marquis de Pombal, was a progressist and decided that it's time to rebuild the new Lisbon. And he did it. And that's the Lisbon we have right now.
Now, you've been working on this since 2009. Can you tell us a little about what this game means to you as a Portuguese man and as a resident of Lisbon?
Yes, it's my new city, right? I decided to make a game about the history of the city where I lived all my life. And it was an important time, 1755, because the Lisbon I visit now, the downtown and all the stores, and where we have some walks, and I lived my youth. Was rebuilt by that guy, the Marquis de Pombal. So I decided that could be an interesting team. And it's really fun because we like economic games, right? So since after the disaster, the economy in Portugal was completely wrecked, people will try to improve that economy also, not just rebuilding the city, but also improve the economy. And that's what I like to have in the games. Most of my games are economic ones. And so I thought the team could be very cool from my city and with the type of games I like to play and design. So
much of the board is the layout, the modern layout of the city with these long, straight streets.
Yeah, it is. It is. Marquis de Pombal decided, we call it the Baixa Pombalina, so Pombalin downtown, so in honor of that man. He decided to draw a city completely clean and straight and very equal, and he did it. So that's why it seems like you are playing in the grid, and that's true, you are playing in the grid, but it's the actual map of downtown is like that. Yeah. And also he decided that each type of business should be only in each street. So he wants to organize Lisbon and with large streets. There's a story that someone asked him, why do you want so large streets? And he just answered that someday these streets will be narrow. And it's true. Right now, with the traffic, we need larger streets than they are now.
Vital, why is this a Kickstarter? You're a very successful designer. You've become a very successful designer in a short amount of time, too. Do you need Kickstarter at this point, or is this a marketing strategy by Eagle Griffin Games?
Well, I think it's both things. So yeah. Eagle Games always does a Kickstarter, and my contract with them have something about it. So this also measures the success of the design, right? You know, after a month, how many games you can sell immediately, or how many people are interested in the game. But Eagle Games always does Kickstarter to all of these games.
Right. How much thinking goes into the price that you set?
Oh, I'm not. I don't have any words about the price of the
right.
But right. I know that they have top notch productions.
It's a big game with lots of parts. It looks fantastic, but I imagine that it's a risk because it makes the game pricier.
Yeah, it's true. But fortunately, one of the things that I like to work with Eagle Games is that they give me green cards to do whatever I want.
Hey.
And I know, I know that they produce the top-notch production. So with all my pieces and big-size boards that I do with Ian, I know that the game will have a great production. I don't like to say this, but I think they want to positioning my games in the deluxe market, right. Okay? Because they are expensive, they are very heavy, you need to have space, and you need to have space to play them, have a lot of pieces. But, that's their politics, and I like it. I cannot say that I don't like it, because I can do whatever I want.
You mentioned Ian O'Toole, the graphic designer from Perth in Australia that you work with.
An illustration. Yeah.
And you're a graphic designer, and you've got a background in advertising and marketing yourself. How did you end up working with this guy on the other side of the world from Portugal?
Oh, I don't know. After Kanban, I was looking for a new graphic designer. And someone told me about Ian. I don't know. I don't remember. And we work well together. So we already did 3 games from that. And I hope to keep working with them in my next games. We have already some plans in the future. I will reprint CO2. So Ian will make the remake of CO2. And I hope Kanban later, or whatever games I came up to, I count with Ian to keep doing the wonderful illustrations he does. So
yeah.
We discussed a lot about the game also. He's also a little bit of developer with me. It's very common. And it's very satisfying to discuss the graphic solutions that we can have to reduce the fiddliness of the tokens or something else. He has great ideas, and I think we have great discussions, and I really like to work with him.
I talked to Ian maybe about a month ago, and it was lovely, and we met him at PAX here in Australia as well.
Yeah, he told me. He told me.
Which was
he's amazing. His art is amazing. He could pass all my ideas about the Portuguese art in the 17th century on the board game. We are playing in the mural, in the Portuguese mural from the 18th century. Mm. That's really beautiful. I hope people understand that those blues and whites are chosen for one reason, not just because. Just because he has a reason to be chosen, And Ian did a great work. I'm really, really happy with the art of the game.
So with your own background in graphic design, and I know that you ran your own creative agency for a while, tell me about the switch that you've made from this normal job to designing board games. And did your wife and family get angry at you?
Oh, yeah, they get, It was...
It's a big change, Vital, it's a big change.
Yeah, I know, it was. But I like change. All my life, I change a lot. So it was not a chosen thing. It happens. I was working in my agency. I had an advertising agency, and I sold my business to my partner and came home. I want to work alone. I want to work as a freelancer, and I did it. And at the same time, I was playing board games, and I decided, since I have more time because I was working alone, I was the owner of my own time, I decided to try to make one game, and I designed the map of Age of Steam at the time, 2008, probably. People like it, the map. We played a lot of times, and I start to like it to do it. My family didn't love the idea. I never stopped working in advertising. I still do.
Okay.
I still do graphic design. Today, my day was almost all day. Not counting with the time I keep my eye on Kickstarter, but most of the day I was working in some advertisings for a client I have. So I keep doing it. I'm not doing design, board game design, full time.
Right.
I'd love to do it, but we never know the future, right? So for now, it's okay. It's good. It's been a great experience, but I don't know tomorrow what happens. And designing a heavy game every year is not an easy task.
So we're going to come back in just a moment with part two of that amazing and fascinating interview with Vital Lacerda. Bam. That I was Dan with Current Riser here on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. With an Iceman Cometh, we're in the middle of our Vitalathon. Woo! Or should we call it a Lisboathon or whatever? But Trent is going to continue his chat to Vital to find out what's on the horizon.
And I know you're working on a Mars-themed game.
But
now terraforming Mars and Ignace's got first Martians. Yeah. Do you have to fight them for the rights to make a game about Mars, or do you have to burn your prototype and start again?
No, I just decided to delay the project a few years. So I have designs that I start from years ago. Some of them are in BGG already. One of them is called Escape Plan. It's a lighter game. That's why I never try to finish it, because it's too light for me. Probably it will be my next game. Since I'm delaying Mars and I have a couple more designs that I'm working on, one of them is, I'm very happy with it. It has a very different team, so I can tell you what is the team, because if I tell you, I told you, I have to kill you.
So. I've heard that you're also working on a game called Dragon's Keeper.
Yeah, true. I started the game 2 years ago with my youngest daughter, and we are still working on it. Even being a family and very light filler, if I'm not happy with the game, I will not finish. So it is not finished yet. So, but I think it will sooner than I expect.
Vital, I'm a father myself, and I have a daughter who's nine, who I like to play games with, and I just love this idea that you've been designing this game with and for your daughter. I just think that's a wonderful thing to do as a dad.
Yeah, when we start to design the game, she has 9 years old. Now she's 12.
Yep.
And we still design.
And she's like, oh, Dad, not again.
But I have one version that is already, because what I want to do is two versions of the game. One that I'm more satisfied because it's a little bit heavy. It's more, has a little bit more depth. And one version that is completed, that to play and to have fun with 7, 8, 6 years old kids. So, and it's been a success, that version. The publisher is waiting for the game on spring, so I think I can accomplish the timing. And I hope you can like it, guys, because it's a very different game than the ones I usually do. But
your games demand a lot of time from the players, and they also demand a lot of repeat plays before you start to understand them completely. I mean, I'm a big fan of The Gallerist. I've only played it 3 or 4 times, and I still don't think that I really fully understand how it is I'm supposed to try and win it. And now there are so many good games coming out all the time. Do you worry that people maybe don't have the time or the attention span that they need to play your games?
Well, what happens, I think, is that people are buying less and less games, but better games.
Mm.
And I hope that the future will be like this. The games are expensive now, are expensive, so the prices are higher than 6 or 7 years ago. And I think people tend to choose better games. And they buy less number of games than a few years ago, but they probably play them more times. I expect that someone who buys one of my games, they are expensive, right? So so they want to try it a few times. I believe that if you try it one time, if you play the game one time and you already know how to play the game and do everything you don't want to, and knows all the strategies or whatever you want to do to win the game, you don't want to play it again. So I think my games have a lot of replayability. I hope so, at least. And because I play them a lot, and I don't win ever, and I don't win often, my games, so they don't have.
Oh, oh good. Me too.
Yeah. So I think the trend is the trend will be this: people will buy less and less games, but will choose better which games they will buy. That's what I'm counting it. I want to deliver players a game that they can play all their lives. I want to give a game that they can study the game, they can set up the game in front of them, have good time just playing alone, and then teach a friend or play with his wife a lot of times. The games take time, yeah, but that's the kind of game that I like to play. Also, I prefer to play one game one night. That gives me a lot of pleasure because I'm 2 or 3 hours around them, then play five or six games in an hour. But that's my way to see. Many people are not like this, but I think those people don't buy my games.
Speaking of trends, one last question before I let you go. There's more and more games that are using digital technology, that are using apps. Is this something that you've thought about exploring yourself?
I'm not looking at it. I'm using a lot of technology to play testing my games right now because I'm play testing the games in Tabletopia. Mm. Many people like this.
Yes.
Because I see a lot of advantage to do it. But I'm not thinking about having something connected to my game, to my board game, or a app or something connected to my board games. Many of the app is used to take maintenance from the game, right? So I think a good design can do that without the app. So unless you have new ideas to use the app, for now I'm not thinking and introduce it, but we never know. A few years ago I didn't thought about using Tabletopia to playtest Lisboa, and it worked. I never playtest a game so many times like Lisboa with so many different minds working in the same table, and it was very fun to see that a table with an Australian and a German and an American in the same table,
wow,
the game is completely different. So works, everybody thinks in a different way. What is good for the Germans playing is not good for the American, or it's very different in the mind of the Australian. And that is very good to see how the different players will react in the different situations. And I'm so happy to find that way to play test my games right now that I think I will keep going because I can find very different minds, very different ways of thinking, and I receive a lot of good feedback because of it. Not counting with meeting a lot of different people.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
We chat during the game like we are doing now, and you saw and you understand new cultures, new ways of thinking, and it's very amazing how an old vehicle like a board game can bring you so much future into your room.
And also bring the history of your city to life again and let everybody know a little bit about the background of Portugal. It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, Lisbon is now a trend, right?
Yeah.
It was not me. It happens. And Lisbon, to visit Lisbon is now a trend. And many people are curious about what happens. Many doesn't understand why I have a grid in the middle of the board. Because that's not the map of the Lisbon, but it is. It is, in fact, the map of the downtown Lisbon. And I had it because of that. I had to take the care of adding a lot of history into the rule book. And I hope, and even in the cards have an event related with the year that you are playing. It doesn't matter for the game, but if you are not doing anything, waiting for someone to play you, can understand or know a little bit more of the history of my city.
I hope the Portuguese government and the Portuguese tourism organization give you some money for promoting their city.
We don't have many players in Portugal, that many, and much less heavy gamers. So my market is the world, really.
Yeah.
It's the world.
Vitale Cerda, it's been a real pleasure talking to you on the Dice Men Cometh. Look, you've funded this great-looking game. It's on Kickstarter. Go and check it out. Thank you again for your time. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure, Trent.
Well, there you go. Wasn't that an interesting conversation? I thought that was fantastic to hear straight from the horse's mouth. The reason behind the game,
yes,
how he loves it, his integration of using Tabletopia to be able to play test.
Yeah.
And that was something Ian mentioned when we were sitting around the table, that he's had numerous games of this and also Vinyos, which he also did the artwork on,
yeah,
with Vitale over Tabletopia. So that's fantastic. Now, there are two things that we didn't mention yet about Lisboa, which I think make it a little bit more intriguing.
You better make it quick, Garth.
First thing is the clergy, because there is a space where you go and visit the cardinal.
Ah, yes.
Now, one of the things that was happening during this time is there was a bit of a paradigm between the nobility and the clergy, because the clergy...
A schism.
They were really powerful. The nobility didn't necessarily like it. But one of the actions you can do, go and visit the clergy. They will give you clergy tiles, which again give you permanent bonuses, and they alter... They sort of add some game-breaking elements,
yeah,
to your own portfolio. But you can cash them in for wigs, which is a really, really cool dynamic,
yeah,
should you want to, and it basically multiplies your score. The other thing that is great is that when you sell goods, they go in down in value forever.
Yeah, that's right.
And they never go back up. And that is two really cool things.
There's
about
that permanent effect. So, look, they mentioned Trent and Vitale mentioned during the interview. Of course, it's on Kickstarter at the moment. Now it's up over or around about the 250,000 mark, because there's this curious system of international pledges where people who can't ship from the Kickstarter locations can back it with local companies, and then that money gets added to the Kickstarter amount. So on Kickstarter, it says 211,000. It's actually about 250. All the stretch goals except the last two are funded. The one I'm excited about is the multi-layer sort of three-dimensional player boards.
That looks so awesome.
To make it really easy to slide the cards under. You can also add on metal coins, which is very exciting. And you can even add on the Vinyos Deluxe Edition and the Gallerist in your pledge. So check it out on Kickstarter. We've spent the whole show talking about Vitale in this game because it is fantastic.
Until now, because you're going to talk about a quick competition, aren't you?
Oh, of course. Very, very quickly, Instagram. Get on Instagram. Check out our Instagram. We've got 1,000-plus followers. We're giving away a $50 voucher from our good friends at Polymorph Games and Hobbies. All you've got to do is post a picture on Instagram. Go to our Instagram post at Dice Men Cometh. You'll find out how to enter. It's really simple. You could win a $50 voucher. We've run out of time, Garth. It's such a huge game, Lisboa. Get on the Kickstarter. Get on to the other Vitale games. They are so amazing, and the artwork of Ian O'Toole. We'll be back next week to talk to you about more games. But until then, bye.
Bye.
This has been an edit of the Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.